Welcome to the Filler IMG podcast. Today's very special guest is Dr. Leif Svalgard, and he's a software developer, solar physicist, researcher, and professor who's been publishing scientific papers since before disco. He's had a very distinguished career, and he has most recently served on the NASA NOAA panel for prediction of solar cycle 24 and is presently with the Stanford HMI team. Dr. Svalgard can discuss complicated and often controversial science topics with the expertise and gentlemanship that still sets the standard for informed scientific discourse. He's a frequent contributor to one of the highest quality solar boards on the internet, solarham.com, formerly solarcycle24.com, and also Anthony Watt's popular blog, What's Up With That. You can check out a ton of his research that he's posted online on his website at leif.org. Dr. Svalgard, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Okay, it's my pleasure.
Thank you. What made you decide to study the sun?
It goes all the way back to when I was a student. In 1967, I was sitting on top of the Greenland inland ice, trying to detect Chinese atomic bomb explosions. And as a byproduct, we were observing the magnetic field of the Earth, which is very much influenced up there by explosions on the sun. And so naturally, I was led from there to the course of all this, which is the sun.
You use all sorts of instrumentation. There's been the STEREO satellites, the SOHO satellites, and SDO. And how does the data from the ground-based solar observatories compare to the data from the MDI instrument on the SOHO satellite or the HMI on SDO?
Well, there are two aspects here. One is that with our spacecraft, we get to observe the sun all the time. We don't have a night and day cycle, and that's very important. We get continuous data, which we cannot get with ground-based. But as far as resolution and sharpness and so on, we can do better on the ground than we can do up in space. It's simply because we can have bigger telescopes down here. We can't send such a huge telescope up in space. It's too expensive. And my real interest is actually how we observed the sun in the past. I'm trying to reconstruct solar activity 100, 200, 300 years ago. So I'm interested in what they did then and how that compares with now. So we're trying to, with the modern instrument, to be able to interpret better what our predecessors saw and try to make sense of it.
We hear a lot of terms bandied about, such as the Maunder and Dalton minimums, and people have a lot of questions about them. Could you please explain to everyone what the Maunder and the Dalton minimums were?
Yeah, the Maunder minimum is a curious period from about 1650 to maybe 1710. The people saw very few sunspots. Sunspots were really discovered with a telescope back in 1610 or so. And there was quite a lot, and people were very excited about it. And then after the next 30, 40 years, they kind of fizzled out and went away. And nobody saw any spots except now and then the single one for about 70 years. And then when they came back in the 18th century, people were quite excited about it. And they began to observe the sun more regularly. And soon, I say 100 years later, the fact that there were no spots back in the 1600s was forgotten. And Rudolf Wolf, a Swiss astronomer, went back, looked back through all the old records and reconstructed the sunspot cycle back then and came up with a rather regular period of 11 years or so. So the notion kind of became ingrained that the sun has this cycle of 11 years, and people kind of forgot that maybe there were no spots back in the 1600s. And then a guy called Gustav Spörer, a German, in the late 1800s, pointed out that there were no spots. And basically, people ignored that, and an Englishman called Maunder kind of tried to draw attention to that, and again, he was ignored because people were kind of used to the fact or to the notion that there had to be a cycle and couldn't really live with the fact that maybe there's not always one. And then in the 1970s, a good and old friend of mine, Jack Eddy, came across these old papers and drew attention to it. And in a very famous paper in the journal Science, pointed out that this Maunder minimum period might have been very unusual because there were very few spots. Now, why was it called the Maunder minimum? That was, Jack tells me that it was because it had a nice ring to it, Maunder minimum, the two M's. Huh? So that was that. And also, Jack Eddy drew attention to the fact that it was cold during that time, so maybe there was a climate connection. So the whole idea of the Maunder minimum and maybe other such minima further back in time would be important for the climate, kind of revitalized this whole idea. The question is, of course, if the sun has had those kind of, we call them grand minima in the past, surely it will have some in the future as well. And there may be some, maybe we are coming to that, but there's a slight possibility that we may have one coming up in the next 20, 30, 40 years or so. This is, of course, just pure speculation, but the sun is really in a funk, if you can use that word here. Some solar activity is getting really low, much lower than we have ever observed during the space age, and certainly lower than anybody alive can remember. So this may be a very exciting time.
There's been, as of yet, no definitive link between solar output and climate, but people are working at it right now. The consensus is that even if we haven't discovered the exact mechanisms and how they work, they'll have enormous impacts on everything from agriculture to space exploration and such. But you've stated that the solar polar fields may have reversed, and this could indicate that we are in solar maximum right now. And I know that there wasn't any consensus. There was predictions made and predictions revised. As it stands right now, looking at all the factors like sunspots and the 10.7 centimeter flux, And other emissions, where would you suggest that we might be at in this point of solar cycle 24?
Well, the this was Yogi Berra or maybe Niels Bohr who said it's very difficult to predict, especially about the future, and that applies here too. The solar polar fields have turned out to be a rather reliable predictor for the cycle, and they have been the last few years very low, lower than we have ever seen them, although we have only measured them for the past 30 or so years, 40 years maybe. And so that kind of points to a small cycle 24, which we are now having. And one characteristic of small cycles is that they fluctuate and vary a lot. So it's the maximum is not a really well-defined. Activity comes and goes and comes and goes for maybe several years. And so we may have one of those situations right now. Usually near maximum, the polar fields reverse because sunspots are dying. Sunspots basically are migrating towards the poles, and the magnetic field will cancel the old polar fields and build up a new one, which then serves as a seed for the next cycle. And that process may take several years and seems to have already begun. In the solar north pole, the field is basically gone, and the south pole, they're much, much weaker than they were only a year ago. So we may have a situation where we are in the maximum period, but that may stretch out for 2 or 3, 4 years. So it does not necessarily mean that this cycle is going to be really short. There's a curious thing here. People, disagree a little bit about how big the cycle is. And every time we have an upward spurt where the cycle really has it goes up, then he goes, I predicted the last cycle, and there it is. And then, of course, it drops down again to very low, and people say, I predicted a low cycle, and there it is. That can go on three or four times, and we shall see how that goes. There's a similar cycle back in the beginning of the 20th century, solar cycle 14. It went the same way, up and down, up and down, up and down, until it finally, in 1913 or so, died. And we may have a repeat of that.
I remember distinctly you saying that wild swings were your exact words. I believe you called it pretty well.
Yes. So those things we may just be seeing one more time. Now, you mentioned the solar output, the solar irradiance, and its influence on climate. One thing we have learned the last 30 years or so is that the sun is not constant. Its output varies. We have also learned that variation is very small. It's one in a thousand. And if you translate that directly into a change in temperature, then you find that that's a very, very small temperature change, less than a tenth of a degree, which, of course, is not something we can really even measure climate-wise. A tenth of a degree is nothing. So unless there's some kind of feedback mechanism, some kind of amplification, those small changes in the solar output will not really have any climate consequences. This is something that where we really don't know. There is the notion that during the modern minimum, the solar output fell even lower than just this one in a thousand. And if that's the case, let's say that it fell by one in a hundred, 1%, then that would have a climate impact. So if we are heading into a modern minimum now, we can see how much the solar output really drops. And if it drops 1%, then there's probably a good chance that there's a climate connection. If it doesn't, then we have to say that the fact that it was cold during the modern minimum is a pure coincidence. So this is an exciting time for that branch of science, but we'll just have to wait and see, basically. I don't think so, and most of my colleagues wouldn't think so either. The sun is a rather normal star, of which there are hundreds of billions that we know of, and the overall structure of these stars is well understood. We observe cycles, star spots and star cycles on other stars, and they behave more or less like the sun. And we believe that the ordinary Maxwell's equations that describe electromagnetism and Newton's laws together should be enough to explain the solar cycle. And we have fairly good theories about it. It's not that we lack an explanation for this. It is that we have too many explanations. We have a whole bunch of theories, and we can't decide which one is the good one. So it's not a total mystery, and I don't think we need any exotic particles or out of this world theories and so on. Now, with SDO, the new satellite we have, we will be able to, in much greater detail than we could before, to look into the sun, just like on the Earth, where we have earthquakes that allows us to observe seismic waves going through the Earth, and we can determine what the structure of the Earth is. We can do the same thing on the sun. We can, in fact, look through the sun and see the backside. Because on the sun, there are sunquakes, just like there are earthquakes on the Earth. In fact, at any given time, there's a million of them going off simultaneously, and we can observe these in great detail, and with SDO we can do that in even greater detail and maybe get a feeling for how the plasma inside the sun flows and how it circulates. And that is really the thing we need to know to explain the solar cycle. And so there's a good chance, but only a chance, that in the next 10 years or so, that we'll have a much better handle on this. So this is an exciting time.
It's a very exciting time. I got to give my much respect to the entire SDO team. You guys are using the Doppler imaging, and as you can see, there's many different wavelengths available. The data stream is huge. It's a huge improvement of SOHO, which was a successful mission in itself in the long past its service life, and it's still going. So the technologies are advancing, and the discoveries being made are incredible. Not only are we seeing the magnetic propagation from under the sun's corona up into the magnetic bubbles at the edge of the heliosphere to the ribbon, and not only that, but we can see G cloud and all these things at once. Observation is key, but at the same time, we're also modeling the minimum. I know that the Harvard Smithsonian did that. We're getting closer towards modeling maximum as it happens. How do you think we can integrate all of the observations and the models into one cohesive kind of structure?
Well, yeah, that's one of the problems we have. We have a data glut, if you like. We have something like a terabyte per day coming in, and that has to be stored, it has to be managed, you have to make sense of it. One advantage there is that, of course, computers now are much more powerful than they were 10 years ago, not to speak how they were when I started in this business. I remember the first computer that I used had 4K of memory, not 4 megabyte or 4 gigabyte, but 4,000 bytes. And you can imagine how weak that was compared to now. So we do have powerful computers to help us with that, to help us with the visualization, to make movies and things like that. And the human brain is a wonderful instrument in a sense, because we can pick up patterns by eye and we can see them, and that can help and guide us to the theory behind this. So the enormous amount of data is a help in the sense that we get to see a variety of things, and we can put the human pattern recognition skill to good use here. But without powerful computers and without cheap storage, which is another thing, we really couldn't do this. And a comment about the difference really between SDO and SOHO, and it has really something to do with the distance. So SOHO is at something called the L1 point. That's about 1 million miles out towards the sun. And since the radio waves decrease in intensity, we need a rather large antenna to pick up signals from a million miles away. So we were using the Deep Space Network, which is expensive to use and has many, many other uses. So that put a limit to the data rate. Now, SDO is in geosynchronous orbit. That means it's just sitting 24,000 miles up. In fact, it's sitting just over New Mexico. And in New Mexico, we have our own little antenna, which is always pointing straight to where SDO is. And we don't have to use the fancy, very large, expensive deep space network. We have a direct, own, private connection, if you like. And that is key to all of this, because the signal is much stronger, of course, when it's only 24,000 miles up rather than a million miles away. And that's really the main difference. It's not because the SDO is that much more sensitive. Like the pixel size is only about twice as good as SOHO. And SOHO was, an image there was, let's say, 1,000 times 1,000 pixels. And now with SDO we get 4,000 by 4,000 pixels, so it's 16 times as much. And but we get it with a cadence which is very high. Every every minute, every 45 seconds, if you like, we get another picture. So we can study the evolution of these things in much greater detail than we could before.
Another really cool aspect of the SDO mission is the mission mascot, Camilla. And Camilla has done a wonderful job of using social media and other outlets. There's been tweet-ups and other events that have really brought a new generation of young people and older people, as, you know, adults, kids. The demographics are very wide. How does it feel having such a large amount of people looking at the sun and thinking about how the sun affects us and living with the star programs and all of this hype in the kind of mainstream of science?
Well, that is, of course, very exciting. And in a sense, we feel we have an obligation almost to do that, because, after all, most of our research is funded by the taxpayers, so we have to give something back. So it's very good that we can do that. Also, we are gratified by the enormous interest there is out there. Now, sadly enough, or sad to say, some of that interest is a little bit on the side of sensationalism, like, we're going to get a big solar storm, we're all going to die, we're not going to have electricity for weeks on end, and so on. And, of course, some of those things are important, but we shouldn't really be carried away by alarmism. And but there's a tendency in the media to overemphasize the unusual, the extremes, and so on. And we have to remember that the sun has gone through its cycles millions or billions of years now, and the Earth has survived every single one of them. We are here, right? So I'm not going to be wiped out tomorrow, I think. But it is very nice to know that people are interested, and we are doing our best to satisfy that interest, both in NASA and also, for example, at Stanford. We put great emphasis on what we call outreach, to make sure that what we do gets out to people. And that's really, in my opinion, one of the most important things here. It's very nice that we can publish papers to other scientists, but the really exciting thing is that we can get this thing out to the man on the street, if you like.
I completely agree with you. Some people do have alarmist tendencies, but there is a big, very big gray area, for example. Some people believe that, you know, CMEs or large instances of energetic geomagnetic activity may be accompanying earthquakes. I know it's the official line that the sun doesn't affect earthquakes right now, but you were speaking about the pattern recognition ability of the human mind, and we've seen that during certain events that there may be an increased risk of above average seismicity. The scales are different, you know. I mean, there's an exponential scale for the Richter scale or whatever they modified it to now, and so comparing it to stuff like the A index and other things is very hard without very expensive and powerful computers. But how do we balance observing the effects of the sun and focusing on these kind of niche ideas and for further study? They may be true or not, but we'll still come away learning something. How do we balance some of these things that may not be accepted by traditional science?
Yeah, well, first we have to realize that if by way of evolution, we are conditioned to see things that are not there. And those false positives are actually beneficial. So if we imagine you are out there on the savannah and you see a shadow in the grass. Now, is that a tiger or not? You may jump to the conclusion, gee, it is a tiger, and run away. Like 99% of the cases, it's not. But the 1% where it serves you well to be afraid of it. So we have a tendency to see things that are not there, and we have to balance what we think we see against the reality here. And one of the tools scientists use for that, there are basically two kinds of tools. One is what we can call the energy argument. Is there enough energy in phenomenon A to account for phenomenon B? That's one thing. And if there's not, then we usually have a problem there. And the other one is repeatability. When we see it now, we may jump to the conclusion that maybe there's a connection, but we can then ask, well, did we see that in the past? Or we can try to predict it in the future, and if that prediction turns out to be okay, then we will look at it in more detail. So the repeatability method is really very, very important. And that's not just for phenomena, it's also very much important, or very important for scientific research. Like if a scientist writes one paper about something, other scientists should try to, and will try to, if it is interesting enough, to reproduce this, to see if they can see the same thing with their data or with their method. And if they can, then that paper gains some credibility, and other scientists will maybe take it up and see if they can see the same thing. But if not, then nothing really happens. So science builds on other people's or other scientists' work. And if you can't build on that because you can't reproduce it, then that work tend to be blissfully forgotten. And we talked about sun and weather and climate and so on. There are more than 2,000 papers peer-reviewed that have been published over the years about this, and we still have not figured out if there's anything to it. And that's one of the problems here. There has been no repeatability there. Paper number 2000 does not build on paper number one or any one of the in-between papers. That's one of the real problems.
But every ejection from the sun is different. It may be a flare, it may be a CME. One may have a different field orientation. One might have a different proton composition. Like, we never get the exact same type of eruption from the sun, correct?
Yeah. I used to say, and I still say it, of course, that the sun is a messy place. And it's even more messy than the Earth, because we have the electric and magnetic forces being much more present there and much, much stronger. And so it's trying to make sense of that is worse than herding cats. We really have to realize that we just cannot make, we cannot generalize from one case only. We have to do sophisticated statistical analysis to see whether or not the same pattern applies in other places and at other times. And that's something which, of course, scientists are trained to do, but the very, let's say, irreproducibility, the very chaotic nature of the sun makes that hard. Now, that does not mean we have not made any progress. On the contrary, we made a lot of progress. The sun is always, a step ahead of us here. The key to this, in my opinion, is to observe the sun for a long time and see if the patterns repeat. Astronomy is maybe unusual in the sense that a piece of data, decades or centuries or millennia old, is still valuable. In fact, the older a piece of data is, the more valuable it is. And so we make great effort to make sure that what we do now can be understood, can be reproduced, can be calibrated by astronomers or physicists 500 years down the road. Because we know that by that time, whatever we observe now will be the key to their understanding.
Another quick thing I'd like to touch on would be a Carrington-style event. I know this is all the popular rage. It kind of leads back to what we were talking about. We know that the media has been kind of pushing the super flare hysteria angle, and that even, science at NASA has pushed stories about this. We know the OECD and the UN and many international and intergovernmental agencies are focusing a lot of attention on a Carrington-style event. Do you think that's kind of disproportionate to the potential for a minima?
No, the Carrington event danger is very real. Now it's more than 150 years ago that we had one, but that's just, you know, like the 500-year flood. It will happen again, and then already then they had, let's say, problems with the technology. The telegraph didn't work, but they were not so much dependent on technology that we are today. Today, a Carrington event will have very dramatic influence. Many of our power systems, power lines, transformers will probably melt if not shut down, or if not taken care of. Many of our satellites will stop functioning. So the key there is that there are two things. First, we can harden our systems, we can build in safeguards so that we, for example, can turn them down, put them into a safe mode, and ride out the storm, so to speak. And then the second thing, which goes hand in hand with the first, is we would like to be able to predict these things, or at least to get a warning. If you can get a one-hour warning even, we might be able to put some of our systems into safe mode to turn off the satellite, maybe even to turn off the power grid, although that last thing is has a real liability problem in it. The power companies don't want to do this because if nothing happens, well, then it was not necessary. But during the shutdown, people might lose their lives. There may be no red light at the intersection. You have accidents, and people on ventilators and respirators in hospitals may die, and so on, so on, so on. So they are loath to actually do anything, right? Unless we can be absolutely sure. And that's kind of a real vicious circle there, right? Because we won't do anything until we are really absolutely sure. And we can only be really absolutely sure when it's right upon us, right? So that has to be handled. But that is a political and juridical law problem, really. It's not a scientific problem. Now, there are some other aspects there. For example, just recently there was a big earthquake in Italy, and seismologists that were in charge of keeping track of earthquakes, some of them are actually accused and are facing jail time because they didn't predict this earthquake. On the other hand, you know, you cannot just say, well, there's going to be an earthquake tomorrow or 3 weeks from now, and then if nothing happens, then what? You can cry wolf too often.
Exactly.
And how do you balance those? We don't really have any experience in that, and human nature being the way it is, we can only get that experience by having a real disaster happening. Huh? So we have some examples of that, like in 1989 in Quebec in Canada, they had a severe power outage because transformers melted, and this was in winter, I think, or in March or something, and several areas were out of power for many, many days, and that's not very nice when it's 20 below, right? When a storm like that happens in Canada, it is a problem. It is somewhat of a disaster. It will last more than just a few hours, and if memory serves, it actually lasted several days, and that's not too nice. Now, the problem there was that the transformers, or a transformer, melted. Now, those transformers are big, expensive, they're custom built, and if you have a really big event like the Carrington, or bigger, the Carrington event may not be the biggest, there are probably ones that are much bigger, we may have several or many of these transformers blow up. And as I said, they're very expensive. They cost millions of dollars. A custom build, they don't have them in stock. You can't say, well, I need 20, send me them tomorrow, because they're not there. And so it will probably, in that case, take months or years to restore this. And I cannot just imagine Canada being out of, or the northern U.S. for that matter, being out of power for a year or two. That would be a really big disaster, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, we know that there was a cascading failure. I think it was back in 2003, so we know that even the failure of a couple of stations can have extreme consequences in these interdependent systems.
Right.
But if it's all right, before we wrap up, I'd really like to kind of switch to a kind of fringe topic. It's not on the list, but we know that the geomagnetic activity could have affected the heart rates of the Russian cosmonauts in space. We know that they can fry the transformers and that we can pick up the signals with many different methods of detecting. But how far of a stretch do you think it would be to think that the change in the geomagnetic field would be on affecting the human physiology?
Well, that's not as far-fetched as some think. On the other hand, it's not as serious as some think. For example, when you have a geomagnetic storm, and there's something called the KP index, which is an index from 0 to 9 of how severe the storm is, there are many people that do pigeon racing, and they bet on these. You've probably heard of those things,
yes.
Right? Yes, and one of the biggest customers for prediction of space weather is the pigeon fanciers, because they don't want to fly their birds if KP is bigger than 4, because the birds get confused and get lost. And that's not fringe, that's a fact. Now, the birds navigate by several means. They look at the sun. By sight, they kind of know the terrain, and they also have little magnetic things in their brain that can sense the direction of the geomagnetic field. And if that changes too much, as it does during a storm, then the pigeons will lose their way. Now, whether or not it has any influence on humans, or any bad or good influence, we really don't know. And personally, I don't think so. Many years ago, I was in the Soviet Union then, as an envoy from the U.S. and to study what the Russians did as far as space weather was concerned, and they had another one over here doing the same. And I visited an asylum for insane people. And the director there showed me a big chart he had on the wall. And he claimed that whenever an interplanetary sector boundary went by, that's the heliospheric current sheet where the interplanetary field changed the sign, that at those times his inmates got completely crazy and agitated. And he suggested, I think not in, it wasn't a joke, he really suggested maybe reports from his institute could help us to predict when these things happen, just by watching how crazy the people went. Now, personally, I think that was kind of a nutty idea, but this guy was quite serious about it. But my own opinion is that this is not a serious problem. Again, the Earth has had very dramatic changes in its field, like a complete reversal of it. And this has happened thousands of times, so when we're still here. A thing that does happen during such times is that the field weakens. And a weaker field means you get more cosmic rays. It means that the solar wind gets easier access. You have stronger magnetic storms. And the influence maybe on satellites and power stations and things might be even larger. But there's some people that believe that the field is just about to change polarity. Personally, I think it's maybe, it's another 1,000 years off or something. But it is a fact that in the last 100 years or so, the field has decreased by 10%, so it's gotten 10% weaker. But we still have a ways to go. I don't think it will happen in 2012, for example.
Or like in the movie Knowing. Did you enjoy that movie?
No, not really. When things get too far out, too far removed from reality, then it's kind of hard to take it seriously. No, I think we have much bigger problems to worry about than the Earth field changing polarity or whatnot. But as I said a little while ago, the danger of large magnetic storms with our interconnected power structure and our very vulnerable satellite systems, and this whole thing being that we're so dependent on the GPS systems and everything, that is something which we cannot really cope with. I think if all these things were down for a month or a year or so, that would have a severe impact on modern society. And that's something that is not on the fringe, that is real. And we need to have a policy in place. What do we do? How do we do it? Or can we even do something about it? And so that to me is something we really need to think about.
Well, everybody should be prepared for any type of emergency, regardless of what the future holds. I'm from the camp that you should, you know, live in the moment and not be afraid of the future. But just going back towards one last thing that I'd like to cover, a lot of people like to use the heart monitors, like their induction magnetometer or their radio detectors as examples that HARP is on when there's a geomagnetic storm or anything. And this is kind of a root cause of a lot of the fear. It's ignorance. How do you think we can get around that and show people that maybe that the government isn't out to kill us, that they do have our best interests at heart, and they're trying to find solutions to these problems?
Well, the credibility of various governments is not really high at the present time, so we may have an uphill struggle there. One of the major things is that the Earth magnetic field, which kind of protects us against these things, is relatively strong. It's 10,000 times stronger than the magnetic field coming from the sun. And that just to give you a feeling for the proportion there, the thing we have to keep in mind. Although the sun's magnetic field at the sun is strong, once it gets out to the Earth, it's weakened a lot simply because of the distance. And the Earth magnetic field is, as I said, 10,000 times stronger. And even if you have one of the very, very large magnetic storms, then that only makes a change in the Earth magnetic field of the order of 1% or something. So these changes are very small. There's one thing maybe that we should bear in mind, and that is that they tend to be concentrated near the polar region. So there the effects are larger. For example, an ordinary old-fashioned compass in northern Canada and Greenland, where I used to live, during a magnetic storm, is completely useless. We have other ways of navigating today. You can use a gyro compass and so on. Up there in the polar regions, the disturbances can be quite large. But people cannot adapt to that as long as we know it. And we just shouldn't stoke the fears there.
And they can be rather spectacular also.
Yeah, many people down here or further south, or most, like 90% or 95% of everybody, has never seen a really beautiful northern light. And they can be quite spectacular. But they happen, 100 miles up, and are not really dangerous. They were just like comets and other other things in the sky. There were, you know, hundreds of years ago, people took them as bad omens and whatnot. I think most people today wouldn't think that way and can just enjoy the show, basically.
Do comets have magnetic fields also, and do they interact with Earth's magnetic fields?
No, not really. Comets don't have a magnetic field. They acquire a magnetic field from the sun. The sun's magnetic field kind of wraps around the comet and is, by the way, responsible for dragging out one of the comet's tails. A comet has two tails, a dust tail, kind of yellow and curved a little bit, and then a bluish iron tail, and that's dragged out as a tail by the solar wind, by the sun's magnetic field. And there's an interesting thing there. Every so often, let's say 3-4 times a month, the sun's, or the magnetic field in interplanetary space where the comet is, changes sign, changes polarity, switches from one to the other. And that upsets the comet so much that it will lose its tail. So if we watch a comet go through one of those polarity reversals, which it does every few weeks, then the comet will literally lose its tail. You see the tail break off and be swept away, and then immediately the comet begins to grow another tail. Now, those tails are very, very thin. We kind of tend to overestimate how big or how important those things are. If you take all the material in a comet tail and you compress it so it has the ordinary density as it had before it left the comet, it would fit in a suitcase. Even though the tail is 100 million miles long. So the things out there are extremely thin. And we can pass straight through the tail. There's no influence whatsoever. We did that in 1910 when Halley's Comet was visiting us. And we do it regularly. And it has no ill effects whatsoever. That does not mean, of course, that there are not people that will try to make money on it, that will stoke fears, that will say, you know, buy my comet powder or my goggles to protect you from whatever, right? And there are always people that will do this. But what we need to do, and maybe there is a real problem, we have an educational problem. We need to educate the public. We need to tell them how things are. Now, luckily, there are many people out there interested in that. And they have quite good knowledge about these things. They should tell their neighbors and whatnot. We should try to raise the level of understanding of or knowledge of what is out there. And the internet is very useful there. There are lots of things on YouTube. You can go and see comet tails and comet plunging into the sun and northern lights, sunspots and eruptions and so on. And that's something which, you know, we couldn't do 10, 20 years ago. So the public now has a much better, or could have, much better understanding of how these things work. At least they're beautiful to us.
Very much so. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming onto the podcast.
Okay, it was my pleasure. Call upon me again if you need to. All right.
You can check out Dr. Svalgard's website at leif.org or also check out sun.stanford.edu. This has been the Solar IMG podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, Doctor.
Yeah.
It's about time that we fell in love. You know that I've been trying. It's about time that we had a laugh. You know that I've been crying. Too many people, too many troubles, too many miles of lying. If everybody laughed for just one day, you know that'd make me happy. Too many troubles, don't know how we live so long. Too many troubles, too many troubles. It's time for us to live a life. One day